G'day wherever you are around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It's time for Light of the Prophets on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letteru.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, my friend.
G'day, you too. I actually noticed something very interesting about Light of the Prophets. If you take the title, if you just take an acronym, it almost comes out the same acronym as Lord of the Rings, so it's just Lord of the Prophets. Lord of the Pringles.
You notice something like that because you can't wait until The Hobbit comes out, I know.
Oh, yeah, it's a question, you know, I keep on dilemming over this, you know, if it's actually okay to read books like this, but the thing is that, you know, Tolkien, it's a very good read, and I've actually asked a lot of religious people what they think, and they say, if you're just reading it for the practice of English, or you're reading it for whatever it might be, then you know, because it's a classic, then maybe it's okay. But, you know, there are dilemmas. I mean, the magic factor in it is not very strong. So it's not like, for example, like Harry Potter, which is just the whole thing is about magic and witchcraft and everything. Here it's more the issue of hope, and essentially, to tell the truth, Tolkien was heavily influenced by the Bible, so his issue with the Messiah there, I mean, Aragorn is a Messiah,
Tolkien and also C.S. Lewis, they were both heavily influenced by the Greek myths and
I think they corresponded with one another. There was something.
Yeah, they mixed. They got a lot of ideas from each other, and they wrote in similar ways. But you know, I watched the, and it is a grey area for some people, I know, and we've had this conversation in regards to Harry Potter with Keith and Nehemia on Torah Pills.
Oh, we also spoke about that.
We did. We have. That's right. We've spoken about it as well. Yeah. But I remember the Lord of the Rings movie. Oh, you know. If I could have extracted the hobbits out of it, I would have loved that film. I don't know what I'm going to do. Well, yeah, I mean, how am I going to survive watching a film just about the hobbits?
No,
Sam, save me, Sam.
I actually watched the first movie, The Hobbit, and it was actually pretty good. I don't think hobbits are that bad because in the characters of the hobbits in the Hobbit movie, and yes, we're not talking about hobbits and stuff like that, but we're going to bring this up for a second. I actually have to disagree with you because the thing is, in the hobbits of, in the story of the Hobbit, the hobbits, you know, are not the main thing. It's actually the dwarves.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to admit, dwarves are totally cool.
They're kind of cool.
Yeah, these little people.
They're little people.
Know, sharpen your battle axe and your hammer. You know, these guys are warriors. So I think that's actually makes a good movie very, very good. But in any case, you're about to say something.
What makes a good movie really, really good is dwarves. This is your tip of the day.
I think that the dwarf characters in Lord of the Rings are very powerful characters. These are characters are warriors, people that have hope and faith and don't give up. They lost their home to Smaug, but they're not giving up. They're going to go and attack that enemy of theirs. And though they're small people, they're still very strong and still very bold about what they should do.
Are there any dwarfs in the Tanakh?
No, the Tanakh doesn't really mention any dwarfs.
Okay.
But we have to remember something. I think it is a metaphor. You know, we're the dwarfs. We're the small people, but we're strong. We have our beliefs. And there's this dragon which keeps on attacking us. You know, it's like a David and Goliath type of thing. You know, it's a classic.
So listen, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. I know there's a new movie coming out soon. I know you can't wait to see it. But the other news is that you're no longer, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, you were the Levite in the old city of Jerusalem. Then you became the Levite in the desert. Now where are you?
I am the Levite in the Galilee.
You finally made it to the Galilee. Are you up in the hills
No, I'm actually on the western side. I'm not too far away from the ocean.
Ooh.
The little ocean we have here called the Mediterranean. So it's a lot more humid here. So unfortunately, I have to walk around with a sleeveless shirt half the time because I'm schwitzing all the time.
But it's beautiful up there. It's lush and green. When I was there, at least, it was gorgeous.
It's very, very green in the Galilee. Actually, if you hop in a car, next time you come to Israel, you can stay with us for it, because we actually now have an extra room.
Woohoo!
We're living
free accommodation at Yoel's place.
I am willing to open my doors to people come to visit Israel, but a few pointers. First of all, I have a family, I have kids, which means that if anyone wants to stay here, First of all, you have to be normal. I will profile. But the other side of it. So, for example, Jono does not get in whatsoever. We have to shoot him on the spot. Next to the door, we just open up the gun and shoot him. So at the moment, I've only invited friends and people I actually know.
Mm. So you're getting the old family house in order. You're there. Your family will join you in a few more weeks. And so we're talking about places like Tiberias. We're talking about places like Haifa.
So I actually can see Mount Carmel and Haifa from basically the building's balcony. So I'm actually living in an apartment.
Uh-huh.
I only lived in a house for like 6 months when we first got married. So I've always lived in apartments. My wife is going to complain about the noise like it's no one's business because she actually grew up living in, a house with a bit of land around it, a very, very quiet area. This is a town. So for example, for this recording, I had to move to the back of the apartment to avoid the noise from the front. We have this huge window. We're talking about really, really big window.
Because you had serenity in the desert. It was silent.
We had serenity. But I have serenity here as well because most of the time it's quiet.
Okay. This is it. See, now I'm up here on Bribey Island, Queensland, and I'm stuck in the middle of suburbia, and it's beautiful to be on an island, but it is suburbia nonetheless, and I'm really, I can't wait to tell you the truth. I can't wait to get back to the farm where I don't have even a neighbor for a kilometer in every direction. It's beautiful.
Well, part of this here, the pluses about living where I'm living now is I'm living in the middle of it's not a city. It's make it create a difference here. Here in Israel, cities are more like towns. I mean, for example, I'm living in a place where there's like 70,000 people living here.
Oh, wow.
But the way the place is structured is not like, for example, a city where you have like huge buildings and there's concrete everywhere. This is more like a town. It's a very, very big town.
Mm.
So you have a lot of green here and you don't have more than, say, a couple dozen people living in the same building, and you walk out, you don't have like huge towering structures in front of you blocking your view and everything. It's very similar to American suburbia, but without the houses, the duplexes and everything. I'll turn out duplexes. Sure. The two-story house and everything. You actually live in apartment buildings, but it feels a bit like suburbia. So, for example, cars do go by and there is noise, but we're not talking about, noise like hundreds of cars passing through your street every hour or something. It's completely different. You know, for example, if you listen now, go for quiet for a second, it's relatively quiet.
Yeah, no, I can't hear anything.
It also means,
of course, you're there by yourself at the moment, and I mentioned the rest of the family will be joining you in a couple of weeks. We have to do Light of the Prophets without Prince Halevi IV.
Yeah, he's not here, and I really, really do miss him. Hopefully I'll be able to see him this weekend.
Yeah.
I miss all my kids. I mean, let's be very blunt. But yesterday, for example, I was watching something, and there was a small child there around his age, and my heart broke for a second there because I'm like, I want my kid. So it's a bit difficult. I'm here by myself. But on the other hand, what it means is that I can continue pushing things to get this place organized. I mean, the houses are more or less finished except for the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
They're still working. They still have to finish off the kitchen because we're waiting for one person to finish his job and then another person to finish his job. And then the kitchen, the final parts of the kitchen can be installed. And that will be that's basically it. That will be the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then he just has to come in with a polish machine, just polish the floor here. That's basically it. But it's pretty amazing to be back here. It's fun to walk in the street and you actually know where everything is.
Mm-hmm.
Intuitively you know where everything is, like as I never really left. It's also fun that people recognize you in the street. A lot more people recognize you in the street than for example, when I was living in Jerusalem. People are in Jerusalem, but it's a very big place. It's 700-something thousand people living there. So some people know you, some people don't know you. Here, my family lived here for about 20 years, so we're well known. I mean,
sure.
We were here when this was still a small town, so people remember my mother. People remember because my mother was one of the very few English teachers. Actually, was an English speaker, so she actually knew what she was talking about.
Yeah.
So she's well known.
So there's a lot of familiar faces still 20 years on.
Yeah, I mean, I walked down the street. There was a really funny incident. I was walking. My wife came here as well. Naomi came here as well, and you know, we're just walking down the street near the post office, and this lady, and she, I think she's from Argentina or something. She starts yelling out to me from, like, I don't know, 50, 60 feet away from here, from where I was standing. And she's like, what are you doing here? Why didn't you tell me you're coming over? I'm like, she hasn't seen me in over 10 years. I've lost a lot of weight. And she recognized me. It was really funny.
And she recognized you. Wow.
And she runs up to me and she says, you know, where have you been? Is this your wife? Why didn't you tell me you're here? If there's anything you need. And she was a very good friend of my mother, and you know, she just realized we're here, and it's a good thing, because a lot of key figures noticed me in the street, and they remembered. So, for example, there's a guy who owns a clothing store. He's owned that clothing store for like 30 years. So I get good prices by him, because my dad, we as a family always bought there when we were kids. So he gives me a bit of discount there as well. So and a lot of things are still here. It's really funny. I haven't really lived here in 12, 13 years. I haven't been here in 10 years, but I haven't lived here in about 12, 13 years. And nothing's really changed.
Mm.
The fun thing is I can walk out and go and buy stuff in the supermarket without having to travel for an hour and everything. So I'm very pleased with that.
That's great. No, that's great. Well, I'm glad it's going well. Look forward to hearing more about that. And you also, by the way, you said you had a couple of ideas for videos where you live, because there's a lot of historical places there. Have you done anything in regards to that as yet, or is that something we're going to keep listeners informed on?
Not yet. I was hoping to do it, but a lot of plans changed because I got phone calls from the contractor, from this, from that, and
so something in the pipeline.
It's something in the pipeline. I'm hoping to get to it next week. I hope. I woke up with a couple of ideas, and I will do them because I promised that now that I have real internet. The only thing is I have to replace the laptop. My laptop is dying, and it's not doing it anymore. So we have to replace the laptop. Nothing I can do about that. It's terrible. Everything that can happen happens when it's the worst time. I'm completely out of money now, so I can't really buy a new computer. But I have to find a way of doing this. So if any of you out there have in their heart to help out, in any case,
HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com.
In any case, the fun part is I can start doing videos. I started working on my website, getting the thing going. The other thing is there's a technical problem that my English is very good, essentially, but I do make grammatical mistakes, specifically when I write. And I don't want to have things lying around. So, for example, if I post something and you see a grammar mistake or a spelling mistake, just do me a favor, drop me a line, either on Facebook or on my email on HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com, and just tell me where the mistakes are, and just go in and correct them, because I have someone who's a proofreader, but they're very, very busy at the moment. They don't really have time to do this for me. I won't be surprised. There's several people actually offered to do this as well. But if I, for example, send it to someone, it might take another week until it gets back, and I won't already post this because the website is getting very, very few hits because there's nothing really going on there. So,
once that's happening, yeah, we'll be plugging it. So there is now. People can go there now, right? But it's not. Can we give them the address yet?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's HebrewInIsrael.wordpress, I think.
HebrewInIsrael.wordpress.com. It's currently being set up, so people can go there and have a look. But it's being set up. But Yoel will be doing some videos at some stage when he finally does get the opportunity, has some free time, and putting them on there. So we're looking forward to seeing some of those.
It's a blog style, and I might at one point just change it to a real website. But at least to start with something, you know. Yeah. I just want to somewhere I can actually post large posts, and it's not a note. For example, a lot of the notes I put on Facebook, a lot of people don't know they're there. Mm-hmm. So as a website, you just see it. So and you go there. So I put in a plugin for categories, and I put in categories and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So you'll be able to search, but I still have to work on it. Mm-hmm. I still have to sit down, work on it, get it moving and everything, and then it'll be a real website.
So like your apartment, it's under construction and it's almost finished.
Exactly. Well, the website's a bit less because I only started working on it yesterday. So
fair enough. All right. So listen, today we're doing 1 Samuel chapter 22. Are you ready for this?
I've been I prepared this one several weeks ago.
Yeah, we haven't had a chance to get to it. We're finally there, and there's a lot in it. And so I'm going to start. It begins like this. It says, David therefore departed from there. Where was there? Where were we up to? Oh, Achish.
Yeah, you know, he was in Gath. Gath.
Yeah, he was in Gath.
And he departed from Gath because he had to run away. We're talking about this at we're not even sure if he actually concealed who he was, but he realized that the mood around him wasn't very good for him. It wasn't, it was probably dangerous for him to actually be there.
So in front of Achish, who was the king, he pretended to be the madman and so on and so forth. We talked about that last week. And it says that he escaped from there to the cave of Adullam. Where's Adullam?
Adullam?
I mean, can I go there today? If I come back to Israel, can I go and visit that place?
Well, again, when it comes to names of places and recognizing them, there are different theories, different opinions. But essentially, this is probably somewhere in the Judean desert. Actually, let me look at one of the sources here.
Because I know Nehemiah.
Actually, no, sorry. Adullam, what they say about the caves of Adullam is actually in the Shfela. So it's Shfela Tiuda, so it's the other side. That's more... actually, that's an area with a lot of caves. There's even a cave there. That was a funny story. Actually, in that area, there are a lot of caves. And in different periods... people used those caves to hide from enemies, and there's stories about the Romans as well. And there's actually a funny case that actually went to one of these caves with Nehemiah. Mm-hmm. And there's one called the Birth Canal. And I am terrified of snakes.
Mm-hmm.
There you have it. Now you know. And I was worried there'd be a snake in there. So he went in once just to make sure there's no snakes. A very, very brave man.
Yeah.
He goes in. And this is a pretty, I mean, Nehemiah and I are not small people. I mean, I'm a bit bigger than Nehemiah.
Yeah, but you're two big guys, right? But what, the cave entrance is not very big?
The cave entrance is big. It's just when you get through it, there's certain people that cannot go through that cave. End of story.
Mm-hmm.
So Nehemiah and I are like on the boulder. We can still squeeze through, but if a bit bigger, and there's no way.
Mm.
So... he went through to make sure, and he's kind of all sweating and huffing and puffing, you know. It's okay, now I'll go with you, but I didn't bring a flashlight with me. So he gave me a cell phone,
mm-hmm.
and I dropped it somewhere in the cave. So I come out, and I'm like, oh, no, his cell phone's not here. So he goes in a third time.
Oh, no.
And I said to him, you know, it's good cardio for you, so. I would have thumped myself if it was
him. So he found it okay.
So we found the cell phone, yeah, thank God. I mean, if I would have lost, I would have paid for it, you know. He gave me something and got lost. But it was somewhere in the cave, so it wasn't really lost. It was very interesting to go through because it was also these caves which were organized in a way that you can actually live in them, where they actually had places where you can actually have pigeons and larger rooms where you can actually sit in them. The whole idea was that the entrances to these rooms were very, very narrow.
Uh-huh.
So if anyone tries to get through, the only way is one at a time. So the Romans, for example, did they smoke people out?
Yeah.
Because the ventilation there is not very good. So you're sitting there, it's not healthy to be there for too long.
Mm-hmm.
So they use these places mostly for refuge. So you could be hiding there for an hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the entrance is small, so you can actually conceal the entrance. No one knows it's there. Now, there are different opinions. There are this one opinion that says it's Tel Ashok Marduch or something. Madhur or something, 5 miles south of Beit Shemesh.
Mm-hmm.
They say 10 miles southeast of Gath. So it might be one of these caves he was hiding in. So these were places, and again, cave dwellers until this very day here in Israel. So it was, making a cave into a nice home wasn't that difficult.
So it seems, verse 2, verse 1, it says that he hid there. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to see him. So, it's not a very well-kept secret that David is there? Or is it likely that he would have sent word out to his family that this is where I am?
See, he probably sent word out, and it's probably they moved because Saul is on a rampage, and we actually see this rampage in a moment. So they realized that now David's marked as enemy of the crown, and it was very common in the ancient world that enemies of the crown, the families, were also dealt with.
Ah,
I mean, it could be that your memory of family, your son, can be, or your cousin can be against the king,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, the king doesn't care. He wants to tell show everyone, you know, you rebel against me, it's dangerous. It's not just dangerous for you personally, it's dangerous for your family. It's dangerous for your family.
So it's likely that he would have sent word to them and that they would have gone to him. And it says, and then it says in verse 2, Yoel, everyone who was in distress, very prominent words that begin with D here, everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, everyone who was discontented, gathered to him, so he became captain over them, and there was about 400 men, Yoel, 400 men. I've also got, it says in my study notes, it says they were drifters and debtors. What do you make of that?
So it goes like this. Kol ish matzok and mar nefesh. This is the first one and the third one. So these are people, these might be drifters. These are antisocial people. Ish matzok. So ish matzok also can be from the person of metzuka, a person who is in some distress.
Mm-hmm.
So this can be just a person that, you know, is poor, is mm-hmm. being attacked by everyone. Also, the man who's a mar nefesh. On the other hand, a mar nefesh is actually a person who's very antisocial. We have the concept of marei nefesh, for example, with the Danites, that they turn around to when they go and Michal runs and says, what are you doing? He says, in penif gilbecha nashim marei nefesh. So maybe that people who are bitter of spirit, people are basically very antisocial, will attack you. People that basically society doesn't want them and they don't want society. So these are people, they find groups to join in. So these are margin people. But also people have debts. You know, they've been run out of their homes and there's no one to take care of them. Now, Saul is obsessed with David. So Saul's not really dealing with trials. He's not really dealing with his job as a king. So now they're hearing there's this man called David. He is a well-known character. He's a leader, and they're saying maybe there's hope joining him. So they go out and they meet up with him.
Maybe there's hope in joining him. But is this a selfish decision? Is this a self-serving decision? Because these people are potentially, if they're in debt, they can't pay off their debts. They're potentially facing slavery. Is this perhaps a way out of that for their own? Do they really care about David, or do they care about themselves?
First of all, the issue of selling for slavery is a bit of a problem, because it says in the Torah in two places. There's in Exodus it says one thing, and then in Deuteronomy it says in Exodus just off the Ten Commandments, it gives two examples of how a person can be sold for slavery. One place, which is the first source, actually says that if a person sells himself to be a slave,
mm-hmm.
in other words, he has no way of financing himself, he has no land, he's just the only way for him to survive is to sell himself or members of his family to slavery. For a period of time. Then you have another situation, a person is sold because he committed a crime, specifically stealing. So a person has a debt, not necessarily is a person that's standing to be sold as a slave, because he can't force someone to be a slave unless they decide to do this or they commit certain types of crimes. So if you have a debt, you find a way to pay off your debt.
Sure.
You have to make the decision. Because if you have a debt and there's nowhere on earth that you're paying this, then you sell yourself to be a slave. But what does it mean you sell yourself to be a slave? I don't think you actually receive money. Maybe what the person does is he goes to the debtor and says, listen, I can't pay you back. I'll be your slave now for several years. Mm.
Yeah, maybe that takes care of it, but it's okay. So the reason why I ask is because when I look at Psalm 142, this is a psalm of contemplation of David, a prayer when he was in the cave.
I was trying to bring that up, that that he was praying, and there's actually a place where it says he was specifically the cave of Adullam.
All right. So my question is verse 4. It says,
just a second. Let me get there. Hold your horses. Was it 147? You said. 142. Yes, verse 4.
So it says, look at my right hand and see, for there is no one, Yoel, there's no one who acknowledges me. Refuge has failed me. No one cares for my soul. Does that reflect on these 400 men?
By the way, in the Hebrew version, that's actually verse 5, by the way.
There you go.
Well, you can. I mean, again, one of the things about the Psalms is that a lot of what's reflected there can be continue into any time, because there's a lot of general ideas. One of the things that they've said when you learn the Book of Psalms is the introduction, that it could be that at the beginning these Psalms were very specific, and then they were adjusted to be more general, became more of a prayer book for the entire nation. Then they adjusted some of the prayers and changed some of the words. But they said that was a very, very early stage, maybe even by King David himself. That the words were that he re-edited his own psalms to be more general. That the introduction is specific, you know, but then you continue on, it becomes something different. It's very, very interesting. For example, Psalm, was it 92, I think, that talks about a psalm for the Sabbath, but when you read the psalm itself, there's no connection. So one of the theories they have is that, that the psalm itself was probably used during the Sabbath, was very popular to be used during the Sabbath, but it wasn't specifically written for the Sabbath. It was, it was the opening, the title there was added later on as a, as, you know, okay, people use it Sabbath, so we're going to give a title for the Sabbath. So same thing here. It's quite possible that some people say the title was added in later on, just to give some kind of historical context. It might be the title here is the original title. Also, the Me'ara, I mean, he hid in several caves. It wasn't just one. He was in several caves. You can't really say it's specifically the cave of Adullam, but it obviously reflects this specific time in his life when he had to hide in caves to avoid Saul. There's actually several psalms here and there that mention this whole thing of hiding in caves, being in caves, and hiding away from the enemy. So here specifically, he also talks about himself. He doesn't really talk about the people that joined him. But the main point here is basically say everyone's forsaken me. No one really cares about me anymore. I was, you know, the warrior of Israel, master of the land. I was the one that brought the army out to battle and brought them back in and everything. And now no one cares for me. You looked at all my directions. No one's looking at me. No one even cares. No one's even asking how I am or what's going on with me. And Dolesh Le'nafshi. There's no one who actually cares for my soul, for my life. I'm just being thrown to the dogs, basically. Without offending dogs, by the way.
Yeah, no, but the question does become, how does that reflect on the 400 men? But we don't have that much more detail, because verse 3 then goes on to say that David went from there to Mizpah, to Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and my mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me. So
there's a question, why did he go to Moab?
Ruth, his great-grandmother.
Yeah, exactly. The classic explanation is that he said, maybe because they know that I'm a descendant of Moab, that his great-grandmother, I think it comes out, great-grandmother, I think it was a Moabite, so they'll recognize the family connection. But I have doubts, not doubts about the interpretation, just I have a question here to King David himself. But doesn't genealogy in the ancient Near East go through the father, which means that this is your great-grandmother, why would they even care? But apparently they did. He goes in, and family ties were very, very important, very, very strong as well. And we even have the Torah, for example, Deuteronomy says, do not hate an Edomite, for he is your brother. Do not hate an Egyptian, for you are a stranger in his land. So that, you know, in the ancient world, they kind of realized that family ties and ancient, you know, old covenants between people actually held even decades later or even centuries later. For example, you have, I think it's Amos that talks about the sins of different nations that surround Israel. And when he turns around to Edom, he says, don't remember the brotherhood. And he turns around to Tzol, basically Hiram, and says, doesn't remember the covenant that they struck with Israel, basically at times of King Solomon. Probably he could turn around to them because of the family ties.
That's certainly a possibility, but he brought them before the king of Moab, and they did dwell with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. It says in verse 4 or 5, says, now the prophet Gad, who is this guy? Does he appear in the Tanakh at all before this point?
No, but I just noticed something. There's an example in the ancient Near East of a man seeking refuge in his mother's country by Idrimi, king of Alalach. He fled to his mother's family at Emar. He was exiled because the leader of a Habiru, this was a clans of lawless people. People didn't have... So David becomes basically like an afiru or a chabiru, that these are lawless people who don't really have anywhere to live. So David has become a pure Hebrew now, a pure afiru here. Mm-hmm. So it says here that he was... it was actually, oh, it's very interesting, that actually a group of afiru or chabiru actually helped the Idrimi to actually return to his throne. So it's very, very similar to King David. Mm. He had a group of landless, lawless people who actually helped him in the end regain his throne. They basically became the core of his army, which is very interesting. So God really, first of all, the name God. So God, first of all, at least two that come to mind now, which are named God. You have the tribe of God.
Yes.
And you have God, the, God HaNavi. So God, is also referred to as God HaChoze at one point. So the difference in between a Navi and a Choze, there's a whole discussion with the word Navi actually means. Some people, there are different interpretations, we won't go into that now. There's also a Choze, which is another type of seer. So now we're starting to see more names. Finally, first of all, we see the name Navi. Before this, we actually had Samuel was called the Ro'eh. He wasn't referred as the Navi. So now we're switching to a different style of language. Maybe now because, we had Chevel Nevi'im, a rope or group of Chevel, this is also a rope, so they're tied together. This is a group of prophets. But now we have an individual also referred to as a prophet. So this is the first actual prophet we have named in the Bible in the book of Samuel. Besides Samuel, this is the first actual prophet we have that's named. We have other prophets. We have, for example, Dvorah Nevi'a, Dvorah the prophetess. But the number of people referred as prophet, at least at this stage, is very, very small. So this is the first one we see in this period who's actually named. Now, he shows up out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And there might be a reason why he shows up out of nowhere. It's creating a contrast. It actually produces something that wasn't there before. We have a prophet. He's involved with King David.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Which gives him... he wouldn't show... I mean, as a prophet, he wouldn't go to David unless he was told. So there's a bit of encouragement behind the scene, encouragement by God saying, no, I'm with you. Because we have to remember, there's the contrast between David and Saul. And David, now he has evidence. A prophet shows up to him out of nowhere and tells him, it starts giving him advice. Saul, on the other hand, and we'll see this later on, he's not answered by anyone, and he's starting to surround himself with very questionable characters, specifically Doeg, which we'll see he does a horrible thing. Yeah, so he actually turns around to him, and he says to him, don't sit at the Metzudah. Metzudah is a fortress now. The word Metzudah, by the way, in Biblical Hebrew, at this stage at least, means fortified cave. So he's still sitting in a cave. Go to the land of Judah, and he goes there, and he goes to the forest of Charet.
Okay,
so this is sort of the contrast. We have a verse here about God and tells him what to do, and David listens to him and goes to Judah and hides in this forest called Charet. And by the way, the Judean Samaria used to be woodlands. It wasn't like it is today. The Turks in the 1800s actually chopped down a lot of the trees in Samaria and really ruined all the forest. There was a massive forest there. In any case, now we have the contrast. Now we're jumping into Saul.
We're into Saul in verse 6. When Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered, and now this kind of reads very clunky. In the New King James that I'm reading from, Yoel, I've got a dash. It says, as if this is almost in brackets, it says, now Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah with his spear in his hand, and all his servants standing around him. And there's another dash in verse 7. Then Saul said, like it's just a little interlude that is put into the middle of the sentence, and it goes, and then Saul said to his servants who stood around him, hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? All of you have conspired against me, and there is no one who reveals to me that my own son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse, and there is no one of you who is sorry for me. How about that? That's what I've got in the English. None of you are sorry for me. You don't care about me. It sort of reads like that. Or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. How about that?
Okay, so first of all, I'm just looking at, yeah, so it's, first of all, David has actually exposed himself, number one. This mm-hmm. is what we see. The movement from the cave into the forest means that he's exposed himself, because the forest is, forests here in Israel are not that big.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously, I mean, you can't really get lost in a forest here in Israel. Sure. For example, in the United States, if you continue walking, you end up in some other country or something. It's not the same thing. In another state. But here in Israel, so by moving to this forest, first he had to move. He had to be on movement, so people probably mm-hmm. saw him.
Mm-hmm.
And when they see a camp of 400 men walking, that's not a small group. I mean, in the intro, even today, 400 men, if I walk in the head of a group of 400 men, will be noticeable.
Yeah, sure.
You know, when there's a demonstration of 100 people, it's noticeable. So 400 is noticeable even today.
So
So it's him and his men. Now, it's very interesting. He's sitting at Giv'ah under a tumerisk, but in the place called Ramah. And the Septuagint actually tries to correct this and say maybe he's a place called Bama, so he might be in a high place. And I've seen commentaries go on about maybe he's a sacrificial area or something like that. Maybe he's trying to appease God. And it might work here because essentially, you know, we have the contrast because we have Nathan, so now Saul's trying to get God on his side as well. So he might be sitting in a place where there's a sacrificial altar. And it might be that this was something to do with Saul, with Samuel, because Samuel was living in a place called Ramah as well.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's a problem here because Giv'ah and Ramah. Giv'ah is one place, Ramah is another place. But it could be that the Ramah is an elevated area in the place called Giv'ah. So that's a possibility as well. Now, the whole idea of why are they also describing the place he's sitting? He's sitting underneath a tree. Slightly reminds us of Devorah. Her place of rulership was under a tree. Okay? And he's also holding a spear in his hand. So they're trying to present spear in his hand as a representation of lordship or rulership. So he's basically, they're setting up that he's sitting there as a king. And he's using his authority of king now to put down this complaint. So now then you actually see the complaint here. And he says, you know, to all his servants who are standing upon him. So the word nitzavim, the word nitzav is something that stands up straight. So he's sitting, they're standing. It's another symbol of rulership.
Mm-hmm.
But nitzavim also means, to be there ready for something.
Mm-hmm.
So these are also people prepared there to serve. Okay. So he's not really by himself and they do care about him, but he's in such a situation of, what's what I'm looking for?
He's whining. It seems to me he's whining.
No, but the mindset is, was it melancholy or something like that?
Melancholy? Yeah, he's very melancholic. Yeah. He's sad. He's sad and he's upset at them because they don't care about him and it's all very...
So he turns, listen to the words he uses here. Turn to the sons of Benjamin. Bnei Yemini. He's using the family ties. Most of his court around him are family.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, with David as well, part of his court is family. For example, Joab is a relative.
Mm-hmm.
Joab and all the rest of the sons of Tzeruiah, these are relatives. These are his nephews, I think it comes out. Mm-hmm. Tzeruiah was one of his sisters. Okay? And he says to them, using an Israeli accent, Gam lechulchem yiten ben Yishai satuch ramim, he says to him, the son of Jesse, that's actually a mocking form. Instead of calling him David, he says, the son of Jesse, that guy. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he talks to them and giving them fields and vineyards and everything and make them ministers. Basically, he's talking about the king's grant. Mm-hmm. That the king had the power, and we also see this in Ezekiel, by the way. If you go to Ezekiel 48, it mentions that the king can give his children. So basically, the Nasi there, which is the prince, the Messiah, whatever you want.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure if that's really the character of the Messiah there. It's a king.
Mm-hmm.
But when we get to Ezekiel in a couple years time, we'll deal with this. But he can give gifts to his children,
mm-hmm.
and he can give gifts to his servants. The same thing. And this was very common in the ancient Near East.
Mm-hmm.
The king had the right, and very common even in Europe. It was the king had the right to give pieces of land to his servants, but not any piece of land. I mean, it had to be something that had to do with him. Mm-hmm. He can't, like, for example, he can't do what Ahav did, where he wanted Navot's
Ahab and Jezebel killed him.
He can't do that. That's a crime. That's actually a crime. But we're talking about pieces of land that he can actually give his servants from his own property. As a king, he had more property, and we also see that in Yechezkel, in Ezekiel.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to him, "Kikshartem kulchem." So the word kesher means a knot, but here in biblical Hebrew, kesher means conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we actually have with Atalia, when she's dethroned and killed, she yells out "Kesher, Kesher," and it basically means a conspiracy.
Hmm. So that's the word that is used in my translation. It says, "All of you have conspired against me." So he's paranoid as well.
And yeah, but the thing is, if you open up your lexicon and look for the word "Kesher," also says a knot. So it's the same idea. So the concept of a knot, putting several things together, putting them together under one idea, mm-hmm. then it also can mean conspiring. So it's how colorful the language actually is.
Mm.
So he keeps on whining about different details. No one tells me anything. My son did a covenant with the son of Jesse.
They're all conspiring against me. Yeah. They don't like me. You know, and no one feels sorry for me, but no one else.
So your translation says sorry. Hebrew says chole. Ve'en chole mikem alai. The word chole actually means sick. So worried sick is basically
really?
What he's saying. No one here is actually worried sick about me. You just carry on with your regular lives. You don't care about the fact that I'm suffering. Basically, he's using the most powerful weapon in the world, Jewish guilt.
It is what he's doing, isn't it?
It's exactly what he's doing.
He's trying to manipulate them into...
We invented this. We invented this idea of Jewish guilt. You won't take it away from us. No, seriously, because the thing is that they said the Benjamites also mixed into Judah. So Benjamites invented Jewish guilt, and it's become part of what we have. You know, Jewish guilt, we're going to use it against you. That's what he basically is doing here. And they're standing there completely embarrassed.
He's sitting there fuming away with his spear in his hand, you know, and under the tamarisk tree. This is the situation that we find him in. It really does set the scene, doesn't it?
Yeah, and now it's very interesting. Now we see the contrast. David has God. Mm-hmm. Saul has Doeg, who's an Edomite.
Yeah.
The contrast. We're jumping into a pretty nasty character.
This is what happens. This is verse 9. Then answered Doeg, because Doeg's there listening, and he goes, "Oh, no one feels sorry for you. Look, I'll be the man. I'll take advantage of this, of the frame of mind that you're in. And I'll be the man." So Doeg steps up and he answers and says, Doeg the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Shaul, and said, "I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob at Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired there of Jehovah for him and gave him provision and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, the Goliath." So now, Yoel, a couple of things about that.
Mm-hmm.
David didn't inquire.
He did not inquire, but the thing is that the sword was behind the ephod.
Uh-huh.
So it looked as if when he went to the ephod to pull out the sword, it looked as if he was asking a question.
Because he went to...
So Doeg is presuming what happened.
That's a possibility, but at the same time, Yoel, he also knows that he got the sword and gave it to him. So it's a possibility that Doeg just blatantly lied, or... He assumes that Ahimelech inquired of Jehovah.
Going on the line of assuming, okay, this is a lesson about what we call Lashon Hara and Rechilut.
Uh-huh.
When you go around rumoring, by rumoring you can spill someone's blood.
Mm.
And this is what happens. I usually don't use rabbinic sources, but I think the rabbinic source here is very, very important for this one.
Sure.
By rumoring and spreading lies, you can bring death on people. And there's a saying, "Chaim v'mavet b'yad ha'lashon." Life and death is in the hands of the tongue.
Mm-hmm.
If you say something about someone, you can be spilling their blood. And I actually had someone try to do that to me a couple months ago. So I went around spreading rumors about me, and someone called me up and said, "You know, this is what they're saying about you." I'm like, "You know, just ignore them. These are a bunch of yentas. They're just interested in rumoring because they want to emphasize how righteous they are. Just ignore it." And that's what we did. It didn't continue on from there.
Very good.
But I've been blacklisted, by the way. I some people realized some things about me and they blacklisted me. So there's some places I'm banned from now. Not that they can really ban me from these places. These are public places, but they might, you know, try to cause trouble if I walk in there. You know, whatever. You know, they can continue living their lives. I don't care.
There it is. So the king sent to Ahimelech. Oh boy, this gets ugly. The king sent to Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all of his father's house, the priests who were in Nob, and they all came to the king, and Shaul said, "Here now."
Notice the family. David's family run away.
But Ahimelech didn't know anything. And there's a reason. You know, exactly. He didn't know he was in danger. Yeah.
Exactly. David's family knew.
Yeah.
He doesn't know anything and look what happened.
He doesn't know anything.
So this is why they went away. We're literally dealing with a chapter that really creates a contrast to present who David is, and who Saul has become.
That's right. So he says, "Hear now, son of Ahitub." He answered, "Here I am, my lord." Then Shaul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day?" Now, I have a question. So is Shaul here in this verse displaying what is possibly the first example of the religious police in the Tanakh? I thought about it for a while. I can't think of another one.
Is this the religious police? Kind of, because he's also telling him, "You can't go ask God for David."
That's exactly what he's doing.
There is an element here of religious police. But I can't really say 100%. It might be, it might not be.
I would love to know from the listeners if they can think of another example. Because what we see here
Another example is with Amos, when he's told to run off. He says, "Oh, go to Judah, give your prophecies there." A priest from the house, from the priest of Bethel is telling a prophet of God, No, we make the decisions, you go away."
True.
And he runs off to the king and says, "Oh, the land cannot contain what Amos is saying about you," and he's using his authority as a priest. So I think that is a certain level of religious police as well.
That's a good example. We can probably apply Jeremiah. Is just about to say Jeremiah.
Jeremiah is a prophet of God, and the priests are telling the other prophets. So that's another type of discussion. It's very interesting. He doesn't. We're coming near now Tisha B'Av, which is the 9th of Av, which is in the rabbinic sources. This is the time when the second temple was destroyed, and this is where usually there's the mourning ceremonies and everything. But you also have, Jeremiah himself. He doesn't contest the possibility of the other prophets being prophets. He just says, "Let's just test to see who tells the truth." Mm-hmm. So that's a different type of idea. But if a Kohen, for example, a priest, walks up and uses his authority as a priest against a man that we know as a fact is a prophet of God, that's some kind of religious police, because I make the decisions here. You have authority over stuff, but I'm telling you what God is actually saying now.
Mm. So maybe, I'm thinking about it now, maybe the rebellion of Korah might have some parallels, maybe?
Rebellion of Korah was more of an issue of wanting the power and wanting the authority, not necessarily really religious police.
That's true. There's this power that he didn't have, that's right.
Yeah, it's more a power struggle, less an issue of telling you what you're supposed to be doing.
Because what we have here, essentially, is a rejected Mashiach, if I can say that, speaking to a current Mashiach, saying that he cannot and should not have consulted God on behalf of the yet-to-be and already anointed Mashiach. I know that sounds kind of confusing, but do you follow me there?
No, I understand what you're saying, but if you must remember that he has authority as a king, but on the other hand, he does no jurisdiction over the temple. This is one of the differences.
Hmm.
The Bible basically looks, the when you look at the, for example, other places, like, for example, latter prophets, you have an issue of the two, I think it's Haggai specifically, Haggai and Zechariah, I think both bring this up, where there's basically two messiahs. There's the Messiah who's the priest, and there's the Messiah who's the king, and they have to work with one another. No,
that's right.
Really, essentially, the priest has no jurisdiction over civil law, and the king has no jurisdiction over religious law.
Mm-hmm.
They have to work together, and it's basically religion and state kind of separated from one another.
In a sense, as far as duty is concerned.
But when the king has to deal with religion, he has no authority.
Mm.
So here, he, as a king, he has no authority to tell me how to do the temple service, if I'm allowed to ask God or not. He can't do that. You can't do that. But he doesn't ask God. This is a blunt lie. But on the other hand, we do have later on the times of the latter kings, like for example King Ahaz, where they started pulling rank into the temple itself and saying, "Well, I'm I'm the king, I'm the absolute authority, and they start telling the people in the temple what to do. Mm. You know, when David, for example, dressed in an ephod, when he says that his sons were in service in the temple, they did it under the restriction of the priest. So they go in, they say, what do we do? They didn't march in and say, we're doing. Mm. And you also have King Uzziah. King Uzziah tried to bring an incense offering, and he was punished by, it says that the leprosy grew on his forehead, and he had to live in the graveyard for the rest of his life. You know, there's a separation here. You're the king, you're the priest. King be in your place, priest be in your place, don't mix.
And Shaul seems to be treating God like a genie in a bottle. Like, you know, we'll only bring him out when I want to know something. You can't do that. Don't you go inquiring of God on behalf of my enemy, and so on and so forth. He has no authority to do that. He's certainly fulfilling the role of the religious police, which he should not be doing. So Ahimelech answered the king and said, and by the way, I want to talk. You said something about assuming the authority and meddling in the authority of the priests. I want to talk about in a minute, if I can, to see if we can draw some parallels in regards to Doeg and Herod, both of them being Edomites. But I'm going to get there in just a minute. I'm just going to read this. So Ahimelech answered the king and said, "Who among all your servants is as faithful as David? Who is the king's son-in-law who goes at your bidding, who is honorable in your house? Did I then inquire of God for him? Far be it from me. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or to any of the house of my father, for your servant knew nothing of all of this, little or much." And he's quite right. But then the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." Then the king turned to the guards who stood about and said, "Turn and kill the priests of Jehovah."
It says that these are runners. This is a guard. This is a guard that probably walked beside his chariot, if he had one, or a donkey or a horse or something. So these are runners, and he says like this something unheard of. He says to them, "Kill the priests.
Kill the priests
now,
of Jehovah.
Kill the priests." Exactly. He also mentions God's name.
Yeah.
And you can imagine how shocked the men were there. It's like, what? What are you talking about?
And I know. And the reason is because he gives because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell me. But the servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of Jehovah. And that's the second time that's happened, by the way, Yoel.
Mm-hmm.
The first time is in 1 Samuel 14, verses 41 to 45, and that's when Shaul declared to Jonathan that you will die, Jonathan. You're going to be put to death. And all the people snatched him away and said, "You're out of your mind, dude. We're not doing that."
Yeah, exactly. So
the same happens to the servants. The servants just stand there and they go, "What? I'm not doing that."
Exactly. Well, they're very, very confused, and they've never heard something like this.
Mm.
It's never been done before.
So who does it?
Because you don't do that.
You don't do that. And he has no authority to do that, but someone does it anyway. What happens?
The king turns around to Doeg and says to him, "You do it."
Mm.
Doeg is not an Israelite, and there's no clear evidence that he actually ever converted.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a few characters here and there in the book of Samuel which are mentioned as not being Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
And what's so interesting is that at least another one of them is also involved in a very, very tragic story, but he's on the other end. And he turns around to them and he says to him, you go hurt the priests.
Mm.
Go hurt the priests. And he's like, okay.
Seems like without hesitation, Doeg the Edomite turned and struck the priest and killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. Also Nob in the city of the priests, he struck with the edge of the sword both men and women and children and nursing infants, oxen, donkeys, sheep, and he killed them all, Yoel, with the edge of the sword. We're to attribute all these deaths to Doeg the Edomite at the command of Shaul.
Yeah, and this is the thing that he does like, not only does, you know, you would think about it. It says in the Torah that you don't punish a son for his father's deeds and a father for his son's deeds. And here, he kills 80 people. He kills 80 priests. He kills children. He kills everything. He treats the city as if it's a city. You know, we have a description in Deuteronomy. It talks about a city that rebels against God. You kill everyone.
Mm.
And this is how he treats it. So not only does he commit murder, he also destroys the property and everything. So this is a, you know, for example, you do that to a city that rebelled against God. These are people who are loyal to God. So this is the, he did the exact opposite of what God commanded.
These are the priests of Jehovah.
These are the priests, exactly. And they point out that specific, by using God's name in the text to create the drama. This is something only an enemy of God and an enemy of Israel will be able to do.
So let me ask you the question, just off the top of your head, without, let's not go too deep into it, but it just occurred to me that during the Herodian dynasty, the high priests were corrupt. They were not sons of Zadok, and...
Yeah, they were actually the Hasmonean, so they were from the house of Jehoyariv.
And he, and Herod himself was an Edomite. Is there any other parallels that that we can make with Doeg?
Both Edomites, but the thing is that Herod kind of respected the laws of the Jews. He wouldn't eat unclean food. He grew a beard. But on the other hand, Herod was the king. He was paranoid. Boy, was he paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very similar to Saul. Both are paranoid characters.
You can almost see a combination of Doeg and Shaul in Herod.
Yeah, but he specifically killed off the family, not all the priests, but he killed off his wife's family, his own son. He killed his wife at one point. Mm. He was completely mad.
Yeah, but he did assert authority in the temple where he had no authority. He placed high priests into power who were not of the line of Eleazar.
Yeah, but that was mostly with the Romans. The Romans did that, and people were paying money to receive that position.
And he was in their pocket, right?
Yeah. I have to look more into the history. It's quite possible that's what happened.
Yeah.
There are some lines you can draw here.
There's something for the listeners to think about.
By the way, I used to live not too far away from his tomb.
I could see your house from his tomb.
Yeah, I used to live next to Herodion, which is basically what they consider to be his tomb.
Mm.
And it's called Herodion because of Herod,
Hordos. Yep.
So it's
there'll be a program on Truth to You about that sometime in the near future, because we did record while we were there, but it's very interesting.
But not with me.
Not with you. You were at home looking after Prince Alevi the IV.
Well, you guys were supposed to come over and visit me with the whole bus, and none of you did. Keith was like, I don't want to go there.
Anyway. So verse 20, it says, now, one of the sons of him, I mean, now you mentioned, okay, so the high priest, the Mashiach, there's two Mashiachs, right? So now one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiatar, is that correct?
Abiatar, yeah.
Escaped and fled after David, and Abiatar told David that Shaul had killed the priests of Jehovah. So David said to Abiatar, I knew that day when Doeg, the Edomite, was there, that he would surely tell Shaul, I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. Stay with me, do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, but you will be safe with me. So, is Abiatar now the high priest?
Essentially, yes.
So here are the two Mashiachs together.
More or less, I mean, at that time, if you remember, this is also the house of Eli. We mentioned this, that these are descendants of the house of Eli. So the punishment had to come at one point. God said to him that he's going to cut them off and get rid of them.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
But what's very interesting is that now, if you remember something, Saul still had some kind of hope to speak with God as well. So he has no prophets. Samuel's completely gone at the moment from the character.
Mm-hmm.
From the characters. But also what's happening is that now he's killed off his last possibility of speaking with God, which is killing the priests who actually had the ephod and were in service.
Mm-hmm.
So he's sealing his own fate.
An ephod?
Yeah, it mentions later on that when he starts talking, it says here in chapter 23, verse 6, and it was when Abiatar, son of Ahimelech, was escaped to David to Keilah, he went down with an ephod.
Okay. So he can inquire of Yehovah for David.
Exactly.
Okay. There we are. There's the two Mashiachs together, two Messiahs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's the way it ends.
Yeah, that's the way it ends. And this ends with a very sad story. David, it kind of gives us a bit of a glimpse to his character. He takes responsibility. He's not Saul. He doesn't blame other people for his mistakes. He says, I knew Doeg was there. I know who Doeg is because I used to be in King Saul's cult. I knew that if he'd see me, he'll probably go and report. He takes responsibility for his actions. He doesn't go around and say, oh, the nation did it. They wanted it. He says, no, I did it. It's my fault. It wasn't even something he did directly, but he takes responsibility.
Mm.
David is a very tormented soul.
Mm.
He suffers a lot. To be a chosen one, you also have to go through a lot of hard things. Moses had to go through a lot of hard stuff. David goes through a lot of hard stuff. So you can draw parallels between these two characters who were types of characters, or art characters of messiahs of sorts.
Mm.
You know, Moses was a savior, David becomes a savior as well.
Yeah.
So there is a certain element here of kind of suffering, but not exactly. Everyone's going to run to Isaiah 53, but we're going to ignore that for now. Both these characters are not going through comfortable stuff.
Sure. No, that's quite right. They carry a heavy burden. Mm-hmm. They do suffer because of the amount of responsibility that they have to carry, and there's an example of that here. So that's 1 Samuel chapter 22. Thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo, my friend, for coming back on to Truth to You. We're going to be doing chapter 23 next week. So until then, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, Kol Tov.